From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Russian President Vladimir Putin is confident his country's faltering economy will improve in 2 years. Past cyber crimes against South Korea link North Korea to the recent Sony attack. 2014 was the deadliest year for migrants, and we visit a boat parade near Washington that's festooned with holiday lights. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. Russian President Vladimir Putin said today he's confident the country's struggling economy will rebound within 2 years and the ruble will stabilize after the currency's dramatic fall in value. But he offered no new remedies for the crisis. At a three-hour end-of-year news conference, Mr. Putin said central bank and economic officials are making a suitable and correct decision to stabilize the value of the currency, even as the country's economy heads to a projected recession next year. He predicted better times ahead for Russia, just not immediately, even if world oil prices remain low or fall more, cutting deeper into revenues from Moscow's key export. He said the economy will inevitably adapt to the environment of low energy prices. It will necessarily be diversified. And second, even if we believe that energy prices will remain low or become even lower, there will be inevitably a point in time when they will start rising again, almost like it's something planned, with a global economic growth and rising energy demand. And I have no doubt this will happen. He said the economy could recover faster if external factors change for the better. Mr. Putin said Western economic sanctions imposed on Russia because of its involvement in Ukraine are 25% to 30% responsible for the current financial crisis. Well, Russia's plunging currency is creating serious concerns for Thailand's multi-billion dollar tourism industry, already suffering for the past year because of political upheaval that culminated in the May 22nd bloodless military coup. VOA correspondent Steve Herman has details from Bangkok.
With the ruble crashing to record lows against the U.S. dollar and other currencies, Russians are cutting back on spending, including overseas travel. That cutback is being felt in places like the beach resort city of Pattaya on the east coast of the Gulf of Thailand. According to the Thai Hotel Association, the loss of the Russians, who are known as big spenders, has resulted in a 70% drop in hotel reservations from Russia during the upcoming high season. Sulada Sarutilavan, director of the Pattaya Office of the Tourism Association of Thailand, tells VOA News, the Russians are second to none for the beach resort known for its licentious nightlife.
Actually, it's a major or main market for Pattaya, Russian tourists. Number one. Last year, we got around 1.7 million Russian tourists to Pattaya.
The number of Russian visitors to all of Thailand totaled 1.4 million through November of this year. But December is shaping up to be a disaster, and the National Hotel Operators Association expects a drop of 50% for the total number of Russian tourists for 2014 compared to last year. Sulada of the Tourism Association says popular destinations such as Pattaya, Phuket, and Samui, all heavily reliant on visitors converting Russian rubles into Thai baht, are expecting things to stay bad for the next 6 months at least.
Naturally, we are worried about this because we don't know when it's going to end. For the tour operator and hoteliers who are dealing with the Russian market, they are quite worried about this, but they are now trying to shift to other markets to compensate with the decreasing number of Russian incoming tourists to Pattaya.
The Thai resort cities and islands dependent on the Russians are putting into place urgent marketing initiatives to make up for the shortfalls by luring short-haul visitors from China and ASEAN region nations. In recent years, the Russian market has been the third largest source of tourists for Thailand. As for those still yearning for an affordable warm escape from the long cold Russian winter, they are said to be shifting vacation plans to Vietnam and Myanmar. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
U.S. President Barack Obama Wednesday described the decision to normalize relations with Cuba as the most significant policy change in more than 50 years, adding it ends an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests. Secretary of State John Kerry described those interests as a prosperous, stable, and democratic Cuba.
There is no other country in the world to which we have closed our lives for as long as we have closed them to Cuba. The Berlin Wall fell 25 years ago, and the wall separating Americans and Cubans has yet to come down. Not only has this policy failed to advance America's goals, it has actually isolated the United States instead of isolating Cuba. And the truth is that we have reached out to countries where our wounds were far deeper than they are with Cuba. In the months ahead, a critical focus of our increased engagement will continue to be improving the Cuban government's respect for human rights and advocating for democratic reforms within Cuba. The change that President Obama announced today will empower the Cuban people to shape their own future. And we all share in ensuring that the people of Cuba enjoy the political, economic, and social freedoms that have spread throughout our hemisphere.
Mr. Kerry says Washington will review the U.S. designation of Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism. President Obama said business and travel ties will be launched, but that he will have to negotiate with the U.S. Congress over ending the country's economic sanctions against Havana. Latin American analyst Mark Jones of Rice University in Texas tells VOA's Victor Beatty the timing for his historic and controversial policy shift was ideal.
Certainly, U.S. presidents historically have been very reluctant to do anything related to Cuba when they were facing a re-election. The general logic was that if a president was seen as soft on Cuba, that could cause him to lose the key swing state of Florida, and that effectively their Cuba policy could be the difference between victory and a second term and defeat and a single term.
Is the Cuban-American community betrayed by this move?
Cuban-American public opinion has been steadily changing on the issue of relations with Cuba. And while certainly some of the older generation of Cuban-Americans, particularly people who were born in Cuba or were born here in the United States a few years after the end of the embargo, retain a level of bitterness and opposition to the Castro regime, but that isn't shared by all of that generation, and it certainly isn't shared by Cuban Americans in their 20s, 30s, and even 40s, by and large. And so I think we've seen a realization among most U.S. politicians that the idea that the entire Cuban American population was supportive of the embargo was something of a myth, and that actually it's a relatively small segment of the Cuban American population that actually strongly supports maintaining a very harsh position on Cuba.
Explain exactly what Wednesday's announcement means.
People are going to be able to send a higher amount of remittances to Cuba. It's going to be much easier for groups and individuals to travel to Cuba. Now, there won't be tourist flights, and not everyone will be able to travel, but the number of people eligible to travel directly to Cuba legally is going to be much larger now. People are going to be able to use their credit cards in Cuba, as well as bring home some rum and cigars, things that presently they can't do. We're going to see greater relations between some U.S. businesses and Cuba, particularly in the areas of building construction materials for the private sector and in telecommunications. Cuba has a very limited internet infrastructure that's accessible really only by tourists and a very small elite. What the reforms will do is democratize the access to the internet in Cuba and thereby provide far more Cubans with the ability to see what the rest of the world is really like.
Mark Jones foresees a gradual liberalization in Cuba on the model of evolving economic freedom in China. Cuban President Raul Castro has undertaken a series of economic reforms, including permitting the purchase and sale of property, starting businesses, and traveling without permission. But the country maintains a one-party state. Ted Henken, a Cuba analyst at Baruch College in New York, says he hopes the policy change will empower the Cuban people to be allowed to demand accountability in their government.
It's important for Cuba to open up to the world. It's important for the world, in this case the United States, to open up to Cuba. What's most important is for the Cuban government to open up to the Cuban people. To me, that's the real sign of a change. And we've seen very, very little in that realm, even though there's been economic reform. presumably the Cuban government represents the Cuban people, but that hasn't been the case for a long time. And I think that the Cuban government must listen to the Cuban people and all the Cuban people and all the plurality of opinions. My hope and my expectation is that this change in U.S. policy will take the focus off of what the U.S. can do for Cuba and put it where it should be on what Cuba and Cubans can do for Cuba.
What's the future of communism in Cuba?
The future of communism in Cuba, actually, I think it's probably done. I mean, it was done, I think, years ago. What we have here is the surviving nationalist revolution that had made significant advances and accomplishments and social guarantees for the people that are often the envy of other countries around the world, a country that has projected those accomplishments and that power around the world in medical missions and other kinds of ways. It's also made itself very famous for standing up to a superpower and for aiding especially other people, other regimes, other governments in Africa. But I think communism was a very little part of those accomplishments, and communism is more of a label of what Cuba was imitating sometimes from Eastern Europe. I think what we have left of that is a certain commitment to socialist values, to a social contract with the people that many people, I think, in Cuba want to preserve, that is much eroded in terms of medical care, in terms of education. But communism itself, there are actually, in my estimation, there are communists in Cuba, but they don't represent the majority, and they definitely don't represent the future.
Does democracy have a hope in Cuba?
Absolutely. I think it does. I think the Cubans I know, both many within the regime, people at universities, I'm a university professor and I have many colleagues who really want a government that respects the will of the people and enacts the will of the people, which is democracy. There are many forms of democracies. There are many shades of democracies. No democracy is perfect. And so those people, plus the many people I know in the opposition, many of the people in the independent media who are pushing for more space, even people who are reformists within the regime want a government that is more responsive to the people and that represents the people truthfully in the various shades of opinion and conviction of the people. So I do think that the democracy has a future in Cuba, but it should be a democracy that emanates from the Cuban people and not exclusively or predominantly from a foreign country.
Americans are generally supportive of the U.S. policy shift, with a Reuters Ipsos poll finding fewer than 20% of those surveyed opposed to establishing diplomatic relations with Cuba. 40% say they favor the change, but nearly that many are not sure. Even in Florida, home to a sizable anti-Castro Cuban exile community, 47 of those surveyed said the U.S. should normalize relations with Havana, while 22% remain opposed. Media reports say U.S. authorities have linked last month's crippling cyber attack against Sony Pictures Entertainment to North Korea. The attack was made to pressure the studio into canceling the release of a film that parodies North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. VOA's Brian Padden reports from Seoul that the incident is familiar to companies in South Korea, which have a history of being targeted by the North.
Simon Choi, a cybersecurity researcher at an antivirus company in Seoul called Hayuri Incorporated, studied the malware codes used to hack into the Sony Corporation's computer system. He says these codes are similar to the ones used in a cyber attack on South Korean media companies in 2012. He says they confirmed that the malware used in the past was from an IP address from North Korea, and the malware found in the Sony Pictures case is the same. So he thinks the Sony Pictures case is related to North Korea. Other security analysts have described the attack as state-sponsored, and several sources said that North Korea was the government involved. A U.S. government official cited in media reports said that Washington has come to the same conclusion, but is hesitant to officially accuse North Korea of launching a cyber terrorism attack. The attack on Sony exposed tens of thousands of sensitive documents. The perpetrators have also threatened to release more unless Sony canceled the planned release of the movie The Interview, a dark comedy about the assassination of Kim Jong-un. The studio and distributors gave in to the demand after the hackers, who call themselves the Guardians of Peace, appeared to threaten physical attacks on the theaters that show the movie. The North Korean government denied involvement in the cyber attack on Sony, but called it a righteous deed and concedes that it may have been done by North Korea supporters. Earlier this year, Pyongyang called the movie itself an act of war. Sony is estimated to have lost more than $100 million in both costs incurred and anticipated revenue just from canceling the movie. But security analysts say cyber attacks can pose much bigger threats to national security, with the potential to shut down power utilities, aviation networks, and financial companies. Kim Hong-kwon, the president of a dissident group called North Korea Intellectual Solidarity, says Pyongyang has been developing their cyber capabilities for over a decade. He says from 2004 to 2009, they were in a stage where they advanced their capability by building their specific strategies and directly attacking South Korea. Since then, North Korea, he says, has entered a stage of improvement and development. It is hard and costly to prevent these attacks. Choi says South Korea has set up a kind of early warning cooperative network to alert companies of any attempts to penetrate cybersecurity. If hacking incidents occur, he says, or malware from North Korea is found, the government will share the information with the companies to respond immediately. The U.S. says it is working to bring the perpetrators of this attack to justice and is considering a range of options to respond. But this could prove difficult given that North Korea is already, for the most part, cut off from the global economy and under United Nations sanctions for pursuing its nuclear program. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. The International Organization for Migration reports 2014 is the deadliest year on record for migrants fleeing conflict, political persecution, and economic hardship. As the world marks International Migrants Day, IOM is calling for urgent action to save the lives of migrants and to stop smugglers from exploiting these vulnerable, desperate people. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
Death has always been an unfortunate part of migration. Since 2000, more than 40,000 migrants have died while trying to cross borders around the world. This past year has been particularly bad. The International Organization for Migration reports some 5,000 people have lost their lives fleeing across seas, remote deserts, or mountains. Most of these deaths, two-thirds, have occurred in the Mediterranean. IOM says more than 3,000 people have drowned while crossing the Mediterranean Sea in flimsy smugglers' boats trying to reach Europe. It says most of those risking their lives are Syrians and Palestinians fleeing conflict, and migrants from the Horn of Africa, particularly Eritreans, desperate to escape fighting, oppression, and poverty. Head of the Migration Research Division at IOM, Frank Lasko, tells VOA there are many smugglers who exploit and profit from the misery of others.
There are suggestions that we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars here, and there is no shortage at the moment of potential clients for the services of these smugglers, so it's a very lucrative business to be in.
There are no easy solutions to the problem of illegal migration. But IOM says cracking down on smugglers and traffickers through tougher sanctions and convictions might dissuade some from entering the business. It urges governments to decriminalize irregular migrants so they can report smugglers to the police for prosecution. IOM fears the number of deaths at sea could rise now that Italy has discontinued Mare Nostrum, a rescue operation which has saved thousands of lives. Mare Nostrum has been replaced by a European Union operation called Triton, which patrols a much smaller area. The agency says an unprecedented number of man-made crises in the world, including conflicts in Syria, Iraq, Libya, the Central African Republic, and South Sudan, are driving migration. It says other factors, such as the Ebola epidemic in West Africa, climate change, and extreme weather, also are pushing people to seek places of refuge. IOM estimates around 232 million people are international migrants. Lasco says that represents about 3% of the world population.
That 3% figure has remained fairly constant over the last 20, 30 years. So globally, we have not seen a major increase in international migration in recent years. However, in some countries, particularly in Europe and North America, Australia, there have been significant increases in immigration. And within those countries, certain cities absorb or attract more migrants than others.
IOM says migration is inevitable. It also is necessary and desirable, especially now when aging societies are short of labor. The agency says migration, when well managed, can be of great benefit to both the countries of origin and destination. For example, it notes migrants around the world send an estimated $435 billion in remittances to their families back home. This, it says, is three times larger than foreign aid to developing countries. It adds these remittances provide a lifeline for many people in impoverished nations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Every December, a large crowd gathers along the harbor in historic Annapolis, Maryland, to enjoy the festive and colorful annual boat parade of lights. A holiday tradition for 32 years, illuminated boats decorated with winter holiday themes circle the harbor. VOA's Deborah Block took in the holiday cheer on board one of the boats.
On this beautiful winter night, people gather at the city dock to watch the boats motor out to the harbor. Alexandra Jones and her husband brought their three small children.
It's our first boat parade, so it's extra exciting because it's boats and Christmas and a parade all at once.
The boat shimmered with an imaginative variety of holiday and nautical themes, from a polar bear to a palm tree with a jumping dolphin. Boating, especially sailing, is popular in Annapolis, which was a lively seaport in the 1700s. It's located on the Severn River that flows into the Chesapeake Bay, the country's largest estuary. Sharon Schilt comes to the parade from her home in neighboring Pennsylvania year after year with boating friends.
It's just really about a celebration about life and a celebration of the holiday.
The holiday spirit is in full swing on Todd Croteau's boat, festooned with a mermaid angel combination he calls a merm angel. The architect designed and created the unique display.
The merm angel is actually laid out on chicken wire. It was laid out in the yard and then zip-tied to the chicken wire. And then after it's all put together, it's rolled up and then hoisted up the mast, just like a sail.
He's had the merm angel in the parade for 11 years and says it's a great way to start the holiday season.
You get to share your talents and your creation with everybody in Annapolis and share the holiday spirit. And I like having all my friends on the boat to experience it with me, and the kids are on the boat singing.
Including his daughter Geneva, who is singing holiday songs with her friends and having a great time.
I have my best friend here, and the lights are really festive.
Jingle all the way.
Dana Leadholm is on a parade boat for the first time.
It's exciting, and you feel like you're, you know, sort of giving joy to the people who are watching.
And with waves and smiles, the crowd shows its appreciation. Deborah Block, VOA News, Annapolis, Maryland.
Well, thank you for joining us today for International Edition. Make sure you look at our website to get the latest on news at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
I can see us on the picture side, sitting with restless side by side. You can be my baby, when you're making my lady, there you
amaze me.